This is No Direction's PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage. PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage was made possible thanks to the support of the Roll for Combat podcast, as well as the dedication of our team of volunteers. Due to possibly questionable language, this panel is rated Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Hacking board games for Pathfinder.
Next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Next year? Yeah. If I run it again. We didn't get a whole lot of signups this year. So I'm changing the title. I hope you all forgive me, but this is Hacking Your Board Games for Pathfinder.
Okay.
And the idea is that every game is fundamentally the same. And so even though Pathfinder has created these subsystems that are often supporting specific styles of play, specific themes, specific feel that they're trying to get, some of them are hit or miss, and so if you are looking for replacements, or if you have something like a story that you're trying to tell that they do not have a subsystem for yet, odds are somewhere on a game shelf there is a game that is that subsystem, and it's easy enough to just take it straight out and use it for Pathfinder, or modify it slightly to use for Pathfinder. Briefly to introduce myself, I'm Ryan Costello. You may know me for the No Direction podcast. I founded it, and I'm the co-host. It's nodirectionpodcast.com. It's a Pathfinder podcast. That's not all I do. I'm the curator for Board Game Mento. That's the subscription box for board games. Every month we will send you at least $80 MSRP, usually closer to $90 or $100, for $50 a month. Every box contains three or four games, and I play all of them. And so we've been running for 2.5 years. I've played a lot of games. I'm really starting to understand how games work a lot better. My other thing is that I am a game designer, so I do have some Pathfinder credits, but for non-role-playing game credits, I did design Orphans and Ashes, which is the game you're seeing here, which is a tile-laying game. It has push-your-luck elements, it has dexterity elements. It is an asymmetrical two-player game, which means that it has two players, and they have rules that are different from each other. So there's some rules that work for everybody, some that are exclusive to each of the characters, which is a lot similar to Pathfinder. Also designed an expansion for the Least I Can Do card game. All of my board game work has been for Blind Ferret, which is the company I work for, because I am a full-time game designer and project designer. So that's why we're here. And the inspiration for this panel came from Lords of Waterdeep. Are you all familiar with this? Mm-hmm. Okay, so just assuming anyone's not, Lords of Waterdeep is a worker placement game set in the Dungeons & Dragons world. It's actually set in the Forgotten Realms. Instead of taking on the role of adventurers, like most Dungeons & Dragons games are, you are taking on the role of the people that give quests to the adventurers, and you all have your own private goals. And so you get to watch the adventurers naively going off on doing quests that are for good while they're actually moving your goals forward. And quests are an element of the game, and adventurers are an element of the game, but the way it works is you go to bars, you go to temples and whatnot, and you say, I need 3 clerics right now, and then you send them on the quest, and if you have the 3 clerics, and the quest says, like, you know, 3 clerics will clear this den of vampires. You score that quest. It's moved you towards your goal. And those clerics are dead. They are returned to the chapel, removed from the game. It doesn't really matter because the PCs effectively become the least important people in Lords of Waterdeep, in a Dungeons & Dragons game, which fascinated me. And I always wanted to play a version of it where you replace the automatic mechanic of if you have this, then that happens, with, if you have this, you now have the chance to make that happen. And the way I considered hacking it was, instead of just saying, these are the requirements to succeed, it's, these are the requirements to go on this quest, and now it becomes a role-playing game. And the person that is going on the quest, and therefore will get points for being on that quest, is the GM. They are trying to actually kill the players in the scenario. And the scenario is described by the quest card. It would take a lot of prep, because you'd actually have to write out a scenario for all of these that could hopefully be played in, like, 20 minutes each, and then all of the other players play the other characters. And the reason you got to keep them engaged and keep them thinking of as Lords of Waterdeep players is that if their character survives this quest, then they get that character, they get that worker, and it becomes theirs, and it continues to be a worker placement game, but they've always got their eyes on their prize as a Lords of Waterdeep player. So that's just a simple hack. Actually, no, that's a very complicated hack. But it's not a hard example because it already starts in a Dungeons & Dragons Pathfinder role-playing type world and just brings that game back into it. So all games effectively have 3 components to them. They have your theme, Lords of Waterdeep, the theme is Dungeons & Dragons, the theme is that you are these Lords of Waterdeep. Usually it's tied into the name. Some games are abstract, and that's kind of the theme, which is the the catch-all. Tic-tac-toe is an abstract game. The theme is nothing. But it still has a theme. It's just the theme is nothingness. The objective. So in tic-tac-toe, the objective is to get three of your symbol in a row. It is a worker placement area control game. You don't think of it like that, but technically speaking, those are the two components to that game. And then conflict resolution. What do you want to do? Pathfinder is run on the D20 system because D20 is your conflict resolution mechanic. So generally, it's if I want to do something, a D20 is involved. If I want to attack that guy, you roll the D20 for success. A skill, D20 for success. Then there's ramifications of that success or failure, and that's where the other dice come in. But success or failure, your resolution mechanic is D20 based. So the way you hack a board game is you take the conflict resolution mechanic and you change it. So let's say tic-tac-toe. So if you want to place a person there, you just do it. It's just a matter of wanting and then you write. So let's say instead of just getting to do that, you had to answer a trivia question. And if you get it right, you get that square. If not, you fail. That's Hollywood Squares. That is 100%. They just took tic-tac-toe and they hacked it. So now let's make it a Pathfinder game. Tic-tac-toe. Let's say it's not just a blank grid. You are now a field. And this is just a conflict between druids. And so you are trying to... Oh, you know what? Let's say it's a conflict between gardeners. And so you are going to do... you have to hit a DC. It's DC 15, and it has to be garden-related. So it can be profession gardener, be knowledge nature, survival. And so then you've got your character sheet. You know what your bonus is. You're rolling your D20. If you succeed, you get it. It makes tic-tac-toe like a five-minute game, but it takes this gardening mechanic that could be like hours of your game, and it could be like to oppress the Lord or whatever reason you have to make this fancy garden. If you've got your three symbols in a row, then that means that you have aesthetically pleased the Lord better than the other person who's just flowers are all over the place unaesthetically. and so it's like, that is a super simple, easy to understand mechanic that absolutely everybody knows tic-tac-toe. Everybody has played it, and that's how you make tic-tac-toe a Pathfinder game. Changing the theme again, if this is war, if this tic-tac-toe board is a continent, and now you have got your armies, your X to earn the square, maybe you have to defeat a monster or whatever, you can roll it out as combat, you can just have a series of recruiting sub-games where it's like, you need to hit diplomacy when you go into this tavern to get people on your side, and then you send them out. And so it becomes every turn is a certain amount of time with a certain single objective, a combat revolution objective, and you know that ultimately you're trying to get that X in that square, and if you fail, the other person has a chance to get it, and if they get three in a row, or if you get three in a row, then you have dominated this territory. Here's the downside, guys. I'm jumping all over the place, and I'm running out of notes. Sticking to the war theme, Risk. Risk is actually an incredibly easy game to hack into Pathfinder because all you need is a map and those rules. And Pathfinder already has a map. And what's great is that if you're having some kind of a war game, you don't need the sides to be fair. Usually they aren't. War is very organic, and that's why Risk has very chaotic and diplomacy similar to it. There are the countries that people say you should play these. They are the easier ones. And it's just because this is a real map that is not balanced because war isn't fair. And so you can do a similar, you can just straight up take the Pathfinder, the Galarian map, or whatever region you are fighting over, because Pathfinder has a lot of maps. And they are well-defined, and all you really have to do is go over with a black marker to make sure that the areas are clear, put your starting points, and then start building your army. Start advancing your army, exactly like Risk, but because it takes place on Galarian, you're using a familiar game that people play in elementary school, people have been playing for decades. Is it close to a century? It's at least 50 years, I think, for Risk. And you are taking one of the most complicated games, one of the subsystems that Pathfinder is having a lot of problem with, and that is the mass combat system, and you just taken a game that everyone already knows, and it's super easy to play. Anyone right now could go home and play Pathfinder Risk, and all you really need is to print out a map. And then going forward, you make subsystems more complex by cascading the conflict resolution. So if you just want to say you have an army, move the army like in Risk, That's fine. That is the easiest way of doing it. If you then want to have building army mechanics, just remember, ultimately a D20 has to be involved in there. So they can be going out, they can be campaigning to get armies, they can campaign to lords to hand over their armies, they can campaign to the other warriors. You can incorporate NPCs, it could be heavy role-playing based mechanics. You can turn risk into a heavy role-playing game just by branching out how many things you have to do before you have confirmed that this is your army, you're in control of it, and it's already balanced based on the conflict resolution that you already know in the game. D20s, and it's based on a game that everyone knows, Risk. It's just turning two different games with some maps and some dice into one subsystem for Pathfinder. All right. I'm going way too fast. I'm going to be done in like 10 minutes. how's everyone doing? Everyone seems to be following along, and everyone, I would say, seems interested in what I'm saying. So let's turn it over to you. What are some of your favorite games? And let me see if I can hack them to Pathfinder before I move on to a different way that you can use board games to inform your Pathfinder game.
Well,
yeah.
One of the easy ones that I thought about when I read the synopsis was, like, oh, Pandemic Legacy.
Yes.
Is a RPG that's a pandemic that was hacked into become an RPG.
Yeah. So if anyone's not familiar with Legacy games, this is Rob Davio who invented this with Risk Legacy. And the idea is you play a game of Risk, and then when you're done, you play the next game in this same world. So if you blow up Tokyo in that first game of Risk, Tokyo's gone in the second game of Risk. And there's rules that specifically say you take the Tokyo card, you rip it up. Yeah. You physically destroy components of this game because you only ever play it once. And then if you found a new nation, you take a permanent marker, you write the name of the nation, you invent it. So if you want to replace Tokyo with, like, Craterville, because of what you I really enjoy Tokyo, so I hope nobody's thinking I'm hating Tokyo. The idea is it's basically a role-playing game, but the role you're playing is the world. Actually, a funny story. So Rob Davio invented Risk Legacy for Hasbro, who owns the rights to Risk. And then he went to, I believe it's Z-Man Games, who owns the rights to Pandemic, pitched them Pandemic Legacy. Pandemic is a game where there are diseases breaking out all over the world, and you and the players are a team of specialists. It's a cooperative game. So you are working together to set up, like, stations where you can go and heal people, and you're just trying to eradicate the virus. And the virus continues to spread. And year after year, you see the ramifications of, like, lowered population and whatnot. This is in the Legacy version. The regular version is just eradicate the disease. Legacy version, it's like, eradicate this much of the disease, and you win. So instead of total annihilation, but then you have to deal with the ramifications of there still being all these diseases out there later. All right, small spoiler, and then you find out that some of the politicians you've been working for and setting up stations for are kind of spreading the disease, they're bioterrorists, and so some of the rounds where it's like, look at all we've achieved this round, they take over, and now you are fighting against your own progress. The funny story is that Hasbro thought they owned Legacy Games, and they don't, and now nobody does, because Legacy Game has become a generic term for that type of role-playing, or that type of game. He released a pirate or a high seas one too. I forget the name, but it kind of fell flat. Seafall, yes. What else were you thinking about Legacy Games? Why was that the one that came to mind?
Just because the way it ended up playing out when we were a group of players, NPCs that were just running around in a pledged goal, and each time a story changed, the goals changed.
Yep.
And our goals were defined over sessions where now before in pandemic, if an outbreak happened, that's bad, but it's not going to end the world. In Pandemic Legacy,
world and then you play again.
Yeah. Yeah. In Pandemic Legacy, if an outbreak happened, that's permanent damage to the map.
Yeah.
Forever. And from now on, that area is now slightly worse and is now more vulnerable to more damage in later games. And it changed how we play the game and made us more nervous every time an outbreak became closer.
And what's interesting about Pandemic, there's only one Pandemic Legacy, but there are different versions of Pandemic. There is a Cthulhu Pandemic, where instead of viruses, you are trying to stop great old ones. And you can just do the same thing. They have just taken... So, in that case, they took the theme, which was viruses, and they changed it to Cthulhu, and then they just kind of changed some of the supporting theme and some of the supporting language to match the new theme. But otherwise, conflict resolution-wise, it is the same game of getting someone there, making sure they're playing the card that represents this threat that they're in, and that means you faced it. And as long as you beat the time, the countdown clock, which is the cards are slowly being played out and things are spreading, and once you're out of that deck, it's done. Or there's actually several ways to lose the game because it's a cooperative game. Yeah, it's an extremely hackable game, and you already are playing roles. Like, you are medics and scientists and stuff. And so if you just want to take that, put it on Galarian, and now you are your characters. And so when you're going somewhere, you just got to remember, it's like, all right, so it's not going to be an all-cleric party, so what are some of the conflicts that a fighter can handle with? Basically, the four archetypes. What are, what kind of, not archetypes, but pillars. So fighters, so warriors, arcanists, clerics, or divinists. And rogues, adventurers, whatever you want to call them, skill monkeys. So, yeah, that's just a matter of tying theme to conflict resolution. And then if you take the legacy model of, like, play to a certain amount, like play a year or whatever, then you can have some downtime before the next year, the next season, whatever it is. And suddenly you've written an adventure path. You've written a campaign just based on Pandemic Legacy, like just opening up a board game that's already out there and it's done the heavy lifting for you. Mm-hmm. It's got the twists and turns and plot twists. What else we got? Who likes a board game? Yes?
A little bit goofy, but Ticket to Ride.
Ticket to Ride's great. So what's great about that is that a lot of the subsystems are not combat, sorry, in Pathfinder, a lot of the subsystems are to deal with not combat, because it's got great combat systems. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Ticket to Ride is about laying track and connecting different cities. And what's great then is that it's madness. It's like, why on earth do I have to go to this city to get to Florida? Like, why do I have to go halfway across Canada? And it's because people were competing and it was a an area control game. So what's great about that is that that could be the start of a campaign, or like the prelude to a campaign, where it's like, this is the different nations spreading. You can do the same thing with Small World. It's like you just use a game of that board game once to lay out a map if you're running an original campaign, like an original setting. And then when the players start going and it's like, all right, you want to save the princess? Well, first you got to go there, across the world, straight down, kind of back up to the middle of the same continent. And you know why. Something I forgot to mention in my intro. Who's familiar with Fireball Island? Really? That's it? Okay, you three? All right, well, Fireball Island is a classic. It's a game from the 80s where you are explorers on an island, and you are trying to gather a diamond, a precious diamond, bring it back and sell it, you know, for money. There is a spirit inside of a volcano on Fireball Island called Volcar, and he is trying to stop you. And the big gimmick of the game is that there's a Volcar miniature at the middle of the map. It's a 3D map with all kinds of like curves and stuff. And you put a red marble in his mouth. And at certain times, you knock it out, and it tries to knock people off of the paths.
Yeah, yes, I remember this game.
Yeah, so Restoration Games just ran a Kickstarter and raised like $10 million to recreate Fireball Island. And one of the stretch goals is a Dungeons & Dragons adventure set on Fireball Island. And I am doing a Pathfinder conversion for the adventure set on Fireball Island. And I am so excited about that.
Marvel had knocked everybody off all the time.
I think they reset the rules entirely. Like, they made it so you could go like a non-straight line kind of thing.
So it's a roll and move game. It's your paths branch because you go into caves and then you randomly pop out another cave. And so that spreads you out on the board and you can be in like a fireball lane if you're not careful. And there are a couple of bridges that go over gorges, and if you're stuck on the bridge when the fireball goes down, like that was a big moment in the commercial, but it never happened.
Yeah.
The odds of you being on that bridge when a fireball dropped and it went down that way because there was still a Plinko effect, the fireballs rolling around. Yeah. But that was when board games had commercials on TV.
Yeah. Yeah. And had a lot of plastic components, like Hungry Hungry Hippo.
I like games with plastic components.
Hungry
Hungry Hippos.
Hack that for Pathfinder.
Immediately I'm thinking that it's just like you let wizards loose on like a material component market. And so you've got to mark something on all the marbles, or you classify them, because I think they're all white, right? They're not color coded?
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, you color code them, and then these represent different components, and then instead of a shopping role-playing game, you're just like, oh, you're going shopping? Boom, hungry, hungry, I'm sorry, you didn't get enough bat guano for your fireball. You could resurrect someone, which is good since you don't have fireball. You probably don't need it. All right, I'm going to call that one a stretch.
Now I
kind of
want to go have a
hungry, hungry wizards. All right, so my next talking point is flavoring your game and flavoring your downtime using board games. So the downtime mechanic is one that was introduced in Ultimate Campaign, and it's one that I find extremely dry. Because downtime is like if you're spending your time when you're not out adventuring, and if you own a tavern, whatever, you can do certain things, and like it's supposed to feel like you own a tavern, but it never does. It just feels like you're rolling a series of dice. Whether you own a tavern or like brothel or a temple, it's the same set of rolls, and it's like the language never changes, nothing ever changes. You just feel like a guy rolling dice and like hopefully getting the benefits you want. So in this case, you wouldn't be hacking it to create a subsystem, but there's millions of board games out there, as I've found out over the last couple of years. So the great thing about board games is that they really have to focus on a single thing. So if you have a board game about running a brothel, and I cannot think of one offhand, so I'm taking a note.
If you find one.
But yeah, so the idea is you flavor your downtime by, before a session, you say, we're going to play this one board game because I have craft something, whatever, craft basket weaving. So let me think of an actual example of a game where you craft. Oh, Potion Explosion. So let's say you are a potion maker. Potion Explosion is a cool game, also with marbles, where it feels like a Candy Crush type game where because of the rig that the Potion Explosion has, you just pour your marbles into the top, and then as you take one on, another one comes down. And it's just a box full of marbles and like five slides. And what's great is that it has the flavor of making potions. It has like different components, it has different things you have to match up to get these potions, which all have cool art and whatnot. And so it informs you as a potion brewer. What would the name of a potion brewer be, like as a profession?
Alchemist?
Yeah, but I didn't want to say alchemist.
Potioneer?
Yes.
Potionist?
So yeah, the idea is that you're not playing this game to win and help your character.
Apothecary.
Is it?
Apothecary makes medicines and things.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but healing potions for sure.
Easy enough.
Magic apothecary.
If you don't want to use alchemist.
Yeah. All right. But yeah, so the idea is you're not playing this game to win and actually succeed at your downtime like mini game. It's just to inform it. It's so that when you are rolling those dice, that's just flavorless. Now you've got flavor. Now you've got something to visualize. You've got names and terms that would apply to that profession. How are we doing for time?
5:25.
5:25. Oh man. So what do you guys want to talk about?
Have you actually put any board games in?
Oh, that's a good question.
In real life.
No, this is all theory.
I'm not gonna lie to you.
That's a good spare.
Yeah.
You know.
It's one of the games that I've got a campaign setting that it's eventually going to get to this board game that works perfectly. It's Master Labyrinth from Ravencraft.
Oh, sure.
The art and that sort of stuff, you know, the idea that they have to actually beat some wizards in order to get through the next step.
Okay. So I know Master Light, like you slide in a tile. It's a tile sliding game. It's basically your tile laying, and it changes the
right. What configuration of the maze. You're collecting ingredients for your master potion, but you have to get them in order because they're numbered 1 through 25.
Yeah.
And then you've got three little wands that let you take an extra turn on your turn or three turns if you want to.
Right.
Be able to move around. So the idea is you get a card at the beginning that's your master potion, and you get bonus points at the end of the game based on how much of your, you know, of your potion you've actually got.
Right.
But the various things and the various ingredients and that sort of stuff would make, you know, like what of the spider. So you can have it be encounters along the way in the course of a magical movie dungeon kind of thing.
Yeah. I know that game has a third act problem where at some point the winner can be clear and undeniable, but you still have to play out the last leg of the game to officially finish it.
Yeah, or you can just say,
yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would definitely be a game you can easily turn into an adventure.
See, I'm really intrigued by this whole market and shopping mechanic now. Not just the Hungry Hungry Bros,
Right.
One of my favorite games growing up was Bazaar.
I don't know Bazaar.
It's so there's five colors of gemstones. And there's like the clear decorative marbles. And you have cards, and you're trying to match the gems on the cards, and you can buy the cards out of the stack.
Okay.
And you have there's two dice, so every turn you roll your two dice, and you get whatever color gems come up. And then you have two cards that are like trading cards, so you can say, if I have a red and a yellow, I can get two blues and a green. And
okay.
You can trade with the bank to buy the cards.
Okay.
So once you have the gems, you put the gems in the thing. And then whoever has the most cards at the end, and there's cards that have a star in the middle that are worth more, whoever's the most cards at the end wins the game because they have the most points.
Okay. So it's got like a chaotic market feel, similar to Hungry Hungry Hippos, but not that chaotic.
Yeah. But it's more conscious because you are wheeling and dealing with, well, the bank. You don't trade with the other players, well, I imagine you could.
Okay.
Where you are consciously trying to buy that thing on the table before the person next to you collects to buy the same thing.
Okay.
But I was thinking about it, and you could still do that thing where you need these five gems to buy this card.
Right.
But have the card be an item.
Yeah, for sure.
Like have a, you know, just to
get
buy
a couple
this,
of item decks.
Yeah.
From
to buy this potion, you need two yellows, a green, and two whites.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm almost kind of half thinking something like, you know, a party makes some money in their downtime by doing trading at the market. They get a bonus amount of money on their downtime depending on how well they measure the game.
Yep. There's a game called Pit.
Yep.
It's a stock market trading game. So you start with a hand of random stocks that you're trying to trade, and then someone rings a bell and it's like, go. And it's just in real time you're screaming like, does somebody have tuna or whatever? Does somebody have tuna? I'm willing to give up this thing for tuna. And you're just like, everyone is passing things all at the same time. Whoever is loudest
so
is
hectic.
Doing better. It is, incredibly hectic.
So
and as soon as somebody has five of the same thing, they ring that bell and the game ends. And it's, it's like, picture any stock market scene you've seen in the movie, it is that. But over nonsense cardboard cards. But it feels so amazing. It is an invigorating game. And it's, that's over 100 years old.
Also a weird game to play at convention because you play it silently.
You could, what?
Three cards or three. Three for three.
Okay.
And you just hold up fingers, and there's everyone staring at each other. It's very quiet and aggressive.
Oh. An intense quiet game.
That sounds pretty weird together. Even more intense.
Just crap.
Yeah. All right, for a second I was going to say loses the visceral element, but I guess it becomes just like an internal visceral element, which is, I bet when you ring that bell, oh man, that would be so much more satisfying.
And ultimately, if you found yourself sitting around a pub, there are the games that you play. I come from a military family, and in the mess, they are games that they play, usually dice games, where the goal is to see who's buying the next round.
Yep.
Usually bluff games. Which are kind
of
cool.
Yeah, Wizards of the Coast released two games like that. One of them is Three Dragon Ante. And so it's just, this is poker in the Dungeons & Dragons world.
Right.
And I believe there's even rules for if you are playing this as your character. Here's how you incorporate bluff, here's how you incorporate sleight of hand.
Oh,
cool. And there's probably the version of Three Dragon Ante Emperor.
I've never played Three Dragon Ante Emperor.
There's a second version of it that
melds
with the first one if you want to.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, we've got a whole bunch of extra stuff.
Cool. And then they also released Infighting, which is a card game about a barroom brawl, but in a D&D setting. So like there is a beholder just trying to drink his beer while chairs are flying around. And like the art is like him just trying to like pull his beer closer and freaking out over the whole thing.
I stocks.
Yeah.
Or the other classic Red Dragon Inn.
Yeah, Red Dragon Inn is another. There's several bar fight games. Red Dragon Inn is great because it is very character focused, and so it is easy to find an analog for your character and actually play it in character. Whereas Infighting, it advertises on a card in the game that you can go to a certain Wizards of the Coast website and make your character, like your D&D character, into a an Infighting character, and they never incorporated that website.
Aww.
So yeah, that was a tease. That was a cart before the horse situation.
It's easier to print something than develop a website.
Yep.
Lesson learned.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, when I first like saw this seminar, I was like, oh, you know what? I have a session coming up where I know I'm going to be missing two players.
Oh, okay.
And then I knew I could sell the other two that would be there on a board game.
Okay.
But for me, like having the board game for everybody and everyone enjoying it rather right. than like the combat portion of Pathfinder, which almost everybody's on board with.
Right.
You know, most of the time. Depending. So like the thing for me is I think the simpler the better. Like when you were saying tic-tac-toe, I was like, oh, I could get everybody in on just doing like figuring out who's gonna bet make the best garden if it goes through or something. Or risk. But like the one I was thinking of incorporating was Dead of Winter, where like they're doing like a base, they're protecting their base from some invasion, and they have like it for this particular, it's the Hell's Rebels adventure path, so they're protecting their base and there's places around the city that they can go to and manage resources. But I know like maybe one or two players isn't gonna be that into it.
Right, it's a little too gamey.
Like, like the gamey part of it. So like how would you manage the gaminess of it? Or like when you come across it in a Pathfinder game, but it gets too gamey for some people who don't like that.
There is a game called, I think it's called Space Cadets, and you are, it's a cooperative game, sort of. It's a parallel play game. So what that means is that, like, some games you just play by yourself with someone else there also playing that game. And a lot of kids' games are like that. They just kind of, everyone's off on their own, and then whoever does it fastest usually wins. In this case, everyone has a different purpose. So if you are in charge of the sensors, then it's a sensory game. You have a bag, and you have to put your hand in, and you have to feel for the right component to pull it out, and then you've achieved your victory, and then your whole crew achieves a victory. If you are in charge of weapons, it's a dice rolling game. And so what you would want to do is find a simple game for the people that don't want a gamey game, and then incorporate that as a component of a much larger game. So if somebody really likes the resource management worker placement thing, then they are kind of the ones overviewing the more complex part of the games. Whereas if somebody just wants a sensory game, then just tell them, get this thing as fast as you can. Like each try represents a round or an hour or whatever. And then just focus on that. Let the people that like the gamey stuff tell you or tabulate your wins. And then that's put towards the larger thing that they're trying to do.
Yeah, because that's been a big thing. Like for Kingmaker, like half the players weren't into it.
Yeah, I've played Kingmaker and Hell's Rebels.
And Hell's Rebels both times. For the Rebellion. Yeah. Like, two people were into it, and two people just wouldn't
look at it. I ran Kingmaker, a few people just took it over, and when new people came in, it's like, we played once, and they just kind of walked off with the Kingmaker part, and they just left after that.
Oh, no.
So they like, we played, well, yeah, they're not very happy, like, okay, this is not a system we understand.
Right.
They're not really flirting, they're just doing the same things they know operate, they're just in the slot machine, they know how to make the system do what they want.
Yeah.
And they just keep on doing that. And it was very hard for a new player to walk into that.
Oh, that's true too. Like when you have people who can game, who like are very good at the game.
Yeah.
They're way ahead of everyone else. And then they're just like, well, we know the system. This is how you game it. You're going to maximize whatever building.
Yeah. So that's what I was talking about earlier, the Act 3 problem. If it's just you've got one runaway player.
Right.
And the solution to that is a blue turtle shell. You need something that lets the last player affect the first player.
If you're incorporating it into an RPG as a subsystem, then it makes sense to make sure that it's something that ties back into the RPG, I would think.
Okay, yeah.
Like, let them use skills or attacks or things that might otherwise not be relevant to the game, but get an opportunity to, because of an opening created by the gap.
Right. Or also having multiple win conditions. So I'm developing a game right now that you're trying to take over an organization. And then once one person is declared the winner, people that are on good terms with them, which is represented by these truce tokens, are okay. And people that are not are executed. So at some point, if it's like, well, this guy's clearly going to win, I'm clearly going to lose, so I'm just going to get on his good side so that I don't feel like the biggest loser in this game. And it'll typically be the person that should really be in second place that gets executed. And so it's like everyone has something to strive for at every point in the game. They get to be like, I want to win or I want to survive. And just your goal changes as you play through it. But as long as at every point in the game you have something to work towards, even if it's like a very Hail Mary shot, as long as there's something that you feel you have control over your destiny at the end of the game, that's ideal board game design. And board game is just another type of game, and every type of game has the same three components that dictate everything that's in the game. So translate that to Pathfinder. So translate to Pathfinder, it kind of is the cleric role in the game, where the cleric has very little to do at the beginning, but he's a good enough fighter that he can contribute until people start falling, and then he gets to shine and be like the guy removing diseases, healing things. So like the arc of an encounter for a cleric is different from the arc of a fighter, which is just like, fighter's a straight line. I want to do the same thing the whole combat. The wizard is the one that will like peak early, and then it becomes a resource management game where it's like, I've used these things, I've figured out his vulnerabilities, and I'm now desperately trying to maximize what I have left to still be influencing this encounter. And then the rogue is similar to the cleric in that starts with not much to do. Actually, no. He's different from the cleric because cleric knows to do combat until it's time for healing. Whereas the rogue is like, I need a couple of rounds to set up and then to maximize what I'm doing. And every now and then I can just be an okay contributor to the fight. But I know that if I do this one round where it doesn't look like I'm contributing, then from that point on, I am super contributing.
Captain Sonar as well for role-based games.
So Captain Sonar is a team versus team sub game where you are divided by basically a GM screen between you. And you just have like a map. I've never played the game. I've only seen it played.
There are four roles. A captain who tells each turn we are going north, east, west, or south.
Right.
A navigator who's listening to the enemy captain who's marking, all right, they said north, they went north.
Yeah.
And they're marking on a map saying, all right, they say no, they're going north, and trying to map, well, here's where they are.
Mm-hmm.
We figure out they're going around this one through an island, they can't be here. Mm-hmm. That's their job. The first mate is monitoring systems, saying this where our torpedoes are charging, our mines are charging, and telling captain, mines are ready. Captain says, mines, fire the mines. And a engineer, whoever time the captain says go a direction, is marking on a sheet, all right, this system's breaking down.
Right.
And it's like
they have to keep the systems
working. Yeah. So it's like a resource management game for the engineer, it's a social game for the captain, and a memory game, and like a deduction game for the navigator.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And so it's a different role for each person, and there's a team versus team.
Yes.
So, yeah.
What's the end goal?
To blow up the enemy ship. So for the navigator, the goal is to locate the enemy ship. Mm-hmm. The captain, to not get shot and obscure the location of the enemy navigator. Your engineer is to properly manage your resources and understand how your captain's generally going to move your ship, mm-hmm. to not destroy critical components of your ship, and be able to repair your ship at critical moments. First mate for managing which resources are available at any given time. To know we need torpedoes at this point, and we need the ability to run very quickly at this point. And that's the general idea for each person having their own goal, the overall destroy enemy ship.
Mm-hmm. If you don't have an exact number of can somebody like multitask?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Could you potentially have one versus many?
You could.
Yes.
Okay.
It seems like it would explode.
There's also real time. They can be played real time or turn based. So you have to be paying real good attention to the enemy captain who's calling things out if you're playing a navigator.
Right. One of the ultimate goals when you are hacking a system like this is to make sure that there's actually a point to it. So this is one of my main complaints about the chase mechanic in the game, where it's typically, if you are chasing a person in an adventure, especially a published adventure, and you catch him, something happens. If you don't catch him, you get whatever happens anyway, just another way, with no penalty, and it's just like, well then what was the point? There's one PFS scenario where you are trying to catch someone, and he's got a vital piece of information, and if you fail to catch him, he gets murdered, and when you finally do catch up to him, you get the note from him, and it's like, there's no point to this. And so I'm bringing this up because if you're hacking Captain Sonar, it shouldn't be a life or death situation between the two subs. It should be some kind of a chase or some kind of like malleable goal where ultimately if you do get it, it's either made something easier so that conflict resolution for a later point becomes easier, or you just lose that and now it's harder for you. But it shouldn't be binary because Pathfinder doesn't do binary very well. Yeah. Pathfinder is about like reacting to the situation you're in now. But the situation is ongoing. It's supposed to be continuous from one encounter to one adventure to one campaign. And when you have like a hard limit, fail this, and the game's over, it's not what the game should be built on.
Well, unless you play like old school D&D.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Yeah. That is your objective.
Yes. Rocks fall in the guys and still in the back pocket.
Right.
I think Pathfinder and Saber Die is not my top of list of things I enjoy.
Right.
No. Mm-hmm.
That's generally what a chase where it's save or win or lose.
Right. Games.
That's why I enjoy the chases where if you win, you got an advantage in the next fight.
Right.
Or it's contributing to the main system of the game, not trying to be its own replacement for it.
Yeah, actually, what's that? There's a Lord of the Rings video game right now with the revenge mechanic or with the NPC mechanic.
Shadow of Mordor.
Yeah, Shadow of Mordor is like, I know it's not a board game, but like the way they handle failure is absolutely amazing because then people get vendettas against you. And like they can use the fact that they've beat you before against you, and like the AI learns so well, and there's like cutscenes that are improvised based on what's happened in the game, and it's like it's mind blowing just to watch it and know that somebody programmed this like it, they didn't program a line of dialogue, they programmed a web of words that can be connected together, and as things again clinko from one thing to another, you get a sentence of like, "Ah, oh, last time you may have dropped my brother, but I then killed you," and it's like, "Yes, that is exactly what happened."
That's just creepy.
It is. Oh no! Somebody was explaining how it's like they defeated the guy but didn't kill him, and he begged for mercy, so they took him on as like a servant, and then they eventually became a lover, and then he betrayed him. But then once again, when they were fighting, he was begging for mercy, and so they saved him once again, and then at another point he was fighting this other rival that he'd created some other relationship with, and just as the rival was about to kill him, the servant came in and saved him. And it's like, this is not the storyline, this is just things lining up based on the actions the players have taken.
God.
And it's like, and we shouldn't be impressed as GMs, because it's like, well, yeah, we do that all the time, but for someone to have figured out a way to make a video game do that.
Say, but it's a computer doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And just so smoothly, it's
wow.
Yeah.
Neat.
Yep.
You ever played Dread? The RPG that uses
Jenga.
Yeah.
Going to bring that up, and I totally forgot. So
yeah.
Yeah, that's actually like the prototypical hacked board game. Yeah. So for people that know, Dread is a horror-based game, and conflict resolution is based on if you can move a Jenga piece from the bottom of the or from somewhere in the tower to the top. So it takes the stress of Jenga and it adds a story to just blocks, to these rectangular wooden pieces that make a tower together. And like the higher the risk, the more pieces you have to take. And is there modifiers to how you take them out?
I'm not sure. I haven't actually played it. That's why I was asking you. Yeah, but I was it seems like something you must have looked into when you were going to do this. But
no, and when Wes was working for Paizo, he always ran a Dread game at PaizoCon and never got into it.
You love that game.
Yeah. And I get it, like it takes the built-in tension of the like of what you're doing and it just adds story.
I don't even know if you have to modify how you take the blocks, because by the time you're getting to that point of Jenga and there's something breathing down your neck and you're trying to escape running down this hallway and the lights are flickering and you're just the modifier is how many people succeeded before you.
Yeah.
It starts off easy, right?
Yeah. And it's got just like a built-in dramatic arc. It's whoever came up with that was a genius.
Bonus points if another player is like strobing a light in your eyes.
And as an example of the way you can change the tone on that, I recently saw Kickstarted a variation on that approach called Starcrossed that uses a Jenga tower for a tragic romance RPG.
Oh, that's clever.
So if the tower falls down, you both die?
Or you're separated forever in some other way.
I do have another, it's a kind of related Jenga anecdote. So Jenga's got like three rules. You touch a block with only one hand. If you touch a block, you have to move it, and you have to move the block from somewhere in the tower up onto the top. And that is the entire game. And people have just interpreted that to mean that you can only use your hand. But it's no, like the designer literally says when she plays the game, like if this is the tower, she will put her elbow around it to brace it. You can just only touch with one of the two hands. You can touch it with absolutely anything else. You can use your chin to balance the game. And so that's just, whenever somebody talks about rules as intended, I'm like, I bet you have no idea how Jenga is intended to be played. What's that?
Intended versus written.
Yeah, exactly.
That's going to change my Jenga game.
Listen, yeah. If you're enjoying the way you're playing Jenga, just play it that way. But if you want to see what she intended, yeah, just get everything but your other hand. Everything else is fair game.
Also, Jenga's a hard game to play in House of Cards.
That's real.
Biggest problem I see using in board games as resolution systems in Pathfinder is that there are a lot more player versus player games and or free for all games and board games than there are cooperative.
It's true. You have to figure out a way to make the game a one versus many. But like, you just have to figure out a way to like, what is this game doing and how to incorporate it. So there's a game called Inverses. It's a party game. And you pull out a card, and it's almost like if you're playing Twister, but your body is Twister. And so it's like you have to put your right hand on your ear, and you have to keep drawing the card to see what you do next. And if your next arm goes on your other ear, then you've got to figure out a way to draw the card. And so if you're just having an encounter with Ettercaps or giant spiders, and you just want to simulate the feeling of like, oh, you're getting sticky and stuff, so now you've got to put your hand on your ear, keep rolling your dice, keep playing your character. But like, it's different now, isn't it? Because you're covered in webs. Let's see. There's probably somewhere I can go with that, because that is a very like kinetic game, and there is no real kinetics to Pathfinder. You are just playing with the same dice and the same mechanics. So I'm trying to think of another really fun kinetic game. There's Twister, but Twister doesn't really... Or does it?
Just torment that rogue.
Yeah.
Like, you have to get across this thing to disarm the trap.
Twister, but Risk.
You show me that.
It feels super roguish.
Whoever can cross the Twister board first.
I can't remember the name. I think it's Dungeon Twister?
Go on.
It's a dexterity-based game where you, it's a cooperative game.
Yep.
And your resolution method is you want to roll this dice onto a target mat, and if you hit a the center of the target or part of the board, you deal damage to the monster. The monsters have modifiers. Mm-hmm. Modifiers are things like use offhand.
Okay.
Or
roll it off your nose.
No. And there's weapons too, and weapons have their own requirements. One like use your person to your left hand to roll.
Okay.
So rooms might have modifiers, your weapons might have modifiers, and that's a dexterity based component of that rolling game.
Okay.
That uses it for the
good news, guys, we're almost out of time.
It also means that your players wouldn't end up with dice all over the floor all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, if you just make your table one giant dice tray, you basically put lips up around your whole table.
We have lips around our table, it does not work. Oh. They still manage to just get the bank shot off.
It just makes the jump farther.
See, I saw a house rule once for Warhammer that was if your die doesn't stay on the table, it's automatically a miss. Because if you hit the table with the die, what chance do you cruise?
We have a similar. If it's on the table, it's a one.
Yeah.
All right, so just to wrap up, this isn't something specific, but just if you are ever looking for components for your game, board games are excellent for that. So Orphans and Ashes has more orphans, like I said, than any other game on the market. And it is just a great way to just fill up with villagers and whatever. They're all generic tokens. They stand out from all the other tokens on the game. And the way that these figures are cheaper than buying that many individual things from like prepackaged is efficient use of molds. So like the most expensive part of plastic components is molds, and so if you're playing a game that has a lot of fire or a lot of orphans, then it's a single mold that gets reused as you do. And same thing, like Tileland Games, the 1-inch square is a very popular size, so if you are looking for modular buildings and for whatever reason Paizo has not released that adventure pack yet, or they have, maybe it's out of print, and you're looking for a cheaper alternative than finding it secondhand. Look at the Tile Land games. Look at games that use a grid, and use Board Game Geek as a resource, because they have amazing categories for everything, so you really can just look at Tile Land or grid-based games, and it will give you a whole chunk of them. And then if you rank them by year, then it's more likely that they are still available on the market. And if they're not, like, some board games are more expensive, but board games are like cars. As soon as you buy it, it's decreased in value by, like, 50%.
Because they expect you to lose pieces.
It's a very cult of the new hobby. And so, yeah, you remove the shrink wrap and it's like, oh, there's probably something newer out there. Plus, it's an industry that scaffolds. So it's like,
here's Pandemic. Now here's Pandemic Legacy. It's just like regular Pandemic, but better, because we learned from Risk Legacy. We took these two great things and made this new, greater thing.
Now here's Season 2.
Yeah, exactly. All right, that's Hacking Your Board Games. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
You all made the second half of this much better than it could have. Thank you for that.
Thank you for joining us for another PaizoCon 2018 seminar recording. Special thanks to the KDCon team, including Justin Sluder, Ryan Hiller, Stephen Glicker, and the entire Roll for Combat crew. No Direction's PaizoCon coverage would not be possible without their tireless effort. To find this and other great Pathfinder podcasts, visit nodirectionpodcast.com.